difícil, muy duro para mí. He sentido que mi corazón me lo partieron en mil pedazos al arrebatar mis hijos de mis brazos.
It feels like they broke my heart into a thousand pieces. That's Jenny Gonzalez Garcia. She's 29 years old, from Guatemala, and she has three children. For weeks, she and her kids were thousands of miles apart. In May, Jenny tried to cross the U.S. border with her kids, who are 11, 9, and 6, but she was apprehended and sent to a detention center in Arizona. And she remembers what a guard told her.
Tú te vas a ir para Guatemala deportada y tus hijos van a quedar en manos del gobierno.
You'll be deported to Guatemala and your children will stay in the hands of the government. Since May, Jenny's children have been held in a foster care agency in New York. The last time they were together as a family was at a processing center in Yuma.
Solo los llamaron y ahí me cerraron, ellos se salieron. Y a mí me cerraron la puerta de ahí donde lo me tenían y yo solo por medio del vidrio vi cuando mis niños pasaron.
They didn't say anything. They just called them and the children came. And then they closed the door and I could see them pass through the window and that was the last time I saw them, says Jenny. Jenny was released from detention last week. She got into a car with a volunteer and they drove 2,500 miles from Eloy, Arizona to East Harlem, New York, where her children are being held. They arrived last night and this morning, Jenny was reunited with her children. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Last month, a court ordered the Trump administration to reunite the estimated 2,000-plus children that have been separated from their parents at the border. But that process is unclear and complicated. Beth Fertig is a senior reporter covering immigration for WNYC, and she joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Beth.
Hi.
So the latest we know so far is that Jenny and her children have been reunited. Can you give us an update on that?
Yeah, I just called another media organization who's camped out outside the foster care agency in East Harlem, where they arranged for Jenny to visit with her three children, and she told me they went in. So she'll be here. She'll be there all day today visiting with the children.
So this is some good news that we're getting out of one of these really difficult stories. Tell us a little bit about Jenny's story herself. She came from Guatemala. Why did she bring her kids across the border? What was she looking to escape in Guatemala?
She told me, and it's a very typical story, as you know, from Central America, where there's a lot of drugs and gangs and violence, that she's from a small town. She has about a sixth grade education. She worked in the fields with her parents. It's an agricultural town. And then she got married and had three small children. By the time her husband left, they were still young. And then she began to fear the, even though it was a small town, there were still some of the gangs in her town. And she thought they would recruit her oldest, who is an 11-year-old boy, because gangs have been going after young children. She also said some weird people were trying to break into her house. She didn't know what was going on. But she just knew that this is bad. I got to get out of here. And she took all three of them on buses to get to the U.S. border. And that's where she was detained in the middle of May in Yuma, Arizona.
So tell us a little bit about what happened when she was detained and what the process was like for her to be separated from her children.
Well, from what I can piece together from talking to her and government sources, she was initially apprehended, I should say, when she illegally crossed the border. She did not go to a legal, quote unquote, port of entry and say, I want asylum. She just, from what she told me, she hopped over a fence of some kind with the kids. And then she was just walking and she got apprehended by, you know, Customs and Border Protection agents, I presume. And then she was brought to a processing center, which is typical. That's where immigrants are brought when they're detained like that. They first go to a processing center, which the immigrants call an ice box. It's very uncomfortable. It's very cold, she says. It was so unpleasant. There were lots of families there with children, and her sweater was taken away for some reason. And then that's where we heard her say, I saw my children taken away. She was seeing other children taken away. And so she claims that there was not even any food, actually, in this place for the first two days that she was there, just juice for the children. And she had told them, if anything happens, memorize this phone number of your aunt and uncle in North Carolina. And then the children were taken, and she was never told where they were going. And then for some reason, and it's likely because there was not another spot in detention ready for her, she was brought to another processing center, another one of these ice boxes, the immigrants call them, for a couple of weeks, which is extremely unusual that she would spend so long in a temporary type of processing center.
And this is away from her children, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And she was not told what was happening. She would ask. She wouldn't get any answers. And then she was finally brought to the Eloy Detention Center on June 6th. And that's when she was able to get more information.
Let's talk a little bit about her attorney. What role did the attorney play in all of this?
In New York, I guess we consider ourselves very pushy people in this city.
No.
And so the children were in the Cayuga Center's foster care agency. The federal government has been taking these children, who they call unaccompanied minors, even though they're really not, to centers that are used to taking the so-called legitimate unaccompanied minors, traditionally teenagers who came to the border by themselves. Cayuga in New York is one of the bigger ones. So they take these teenagers if they don't have family to go to, and they place them in foster homes. So all of a sudden, Cayuga was overwhelmed with hundreds of kids who had been separated from their parents, younger than they're usually dealing with. They have these three small children. The three small children, one of them or all of them knew the phone number and gave it to Cayuga, foster care caseworker, who then called the aunt and uncle in North Carolina. And that family was very surprised to hear that these children are in foster care. Apparently, they didn't even know where Jenny was at that point or what was happening exactly. And when they heard it was a foster care agency in New York, they literally Googled immigration lawyer Bronx, because that's where the agency was based, and they found Jose Javier Orochena, who thankfully, because there are some bad actors out there in the immigration sphere, was a legitimate lawyer. And he pushed and pushed and pushed for weeks to try to see the children because he was by then signed up to be Jenny's attorney. And he wasn't allowed inside, and he was very frustrated. And we interviewed him on WNYC about that a couple of weeks ago.
We actually have a clip from that we can play.
Sure. Have you been able to talk to the mom about how the children are doing in New York? Because you have not yet spoken to the children yourself.
No, I haven't. I've only been able to speak with the aunt who's advocating for them to be released to her in North Carolina.
And from what the aunt has told you, are they doing okay?
They are just told a generic, they're fine, they're fine. They speak to their mother. They're not even part of a system. For example, I called immigration court here in New York and I asked, when are the children scheduled to go in front of an immigration judge? They told me that their system reflects that the children are still in Arizona. So I think that the only possibility of reuniting Jenny Gonzalez with her three children is that she gets bonded out, comes to New York and picks up her children and fights her asylum case outside of the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
And a listener in Long Island City named Julie Schwietert-Colazzo heard the interview with him on WMIC expressing his frustration, and she raised money to bond this woman out of detention because Orochena, because he was a lawyer representing her. Most of these moms don't have lawyers on the outside.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Like, what ends up happening if you're somebody that can't get a lawyer
or just the majority
have someone raise money because they're feeling generous? Like, what happens to people?
Yeah,
who are
this was kind of like a unicorn in that the family contacted a lawyer who was able to represent her and push, you know, being a pushy New Yorker, kept trying to see the kids, and then made a deal with ICE to bond her out for $7,500. And when these volunteers had raised enough money just in time for that, he flew to Arizona. We went with him. And he got her out of detention on Thursday. And then other volunteers drove her all the way to New York. So this is a very unusual story.
And so for those people who don't have access, we've been hearing about the shortage of attorneys and pro bono folks who are able to help these folks. Where do people go to find their children? For example, if Jenny's kids didn't have the phone number written or memorized, what would have happened to them?
Well, in New York, and I believe in general, there's a process for the foster care agencies taking these kids to have legal screening. In New York, it's Catholic Charities of New York. They told me they have screened all of the children who are in the foster care agencies in New York by now. And they are giving some of them legal representation. Others, they're waiting to connect with the families to hear what they want. And most of the children, they said, just want to go back to their home countries, which is because, you know, a lot of the parents are going to be deported, let's face it. And so then it's going to be a mess of matching the kids with the parents, either before they go back to their home countries or after. But some of the kids may have legit asylum cases that the attorneys will bring on behalf of the moms or fathers, just like Jose Javier Orochena is going to do for Jenny Gonzalez Garcia. He says she does have an asylum case and he wants to represent her. However, she will probably move to North Carolina where those relatives are. And then it will be another lawyer because her case will be transferred to the immigration court there.
You mentioned Cayuga, the center where a lot of these children are here in East Harlem. How are they handling this influx of children that they weren't expecting to have necessarily?
I honestly don't know because they have refused to talk to any media. They won't return any calls. I briefly went in there with the lawyer when he finally got to visit the children last week, and I could see a lot of young people running around. It seemed like they've never handled anything like this before, and they're really under a lot of pressure because they have a contract with the federal government, and they probably feel like we got to be pretty careful here. But as to your question about the lawyers, I can tell you that when women, parents are in detention, they are given a list of legal service organizations, but the very, very few of them can handle the volume like this. And so Jenny, when she was released, got a slip of paper with the names of local legal service organizations in the Phoenix area. Thankfully, she already had her own attorney, but it's doubtful that they could have handled every one of those people who are being, you know, pulled into detention right now. And here in New York, where immigrants have the best chance of representation, according to data. Most of them do have lawyers when they go to immigration court. I'm hearing from the lawyers that they are overwhelmed, partly because the cases have become more complicated now under the Trump administration. And so they're taking longer to do their cases, which makes it harder to represent every person that they would like to represent.
What happens to Jenny and her kids now?
Well, she will visit with them today. She cannot be formally reunited with them in terms of having them in her custody because there's a big bureaucracy right now. The federal government has decided that they want to treat every parent as though they're a sponsor and interview them, background check, fingerprint, all this stuff to make sure they are who they are. So at this point, it's going to be quicker probably to release the children to the aunt and uncle in North Carolina who have already gone through that process, and then they will all have to go there.
Beth Fertig is a senior reporter at WNYC covering immigration. Beth, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
As we head into July 4th, we're asking you, how do you define patriotism in 2018? Do you feel patriotic?
This is Lou Stern from Falmouth, Massachusetts. Patriotism is to be fiercely loyal to our Constitution and democracy. I've realized that I need and want to be more patriotic to protect everything I value and hold dear. I feel patriotic in my thoughts, feelings, words, and actions that defend our Constitution and country from the threat of destruction by our unpatriotic leaders and the people who follow and defend them.
Hey, my name is Janine, and I'm calling from New York City. And I think patriotism is loving your country, but with inclusiveness. It's fighting for fairness and equality for all, even if there's a price you must pay for it, as in, say, higher taxes.
Do you feel patriotic? Why or why not? Tweet us at The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Since Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico last September, close to 2,000 evacuees have been living in hotels across the United States through a temporary voucher program operated by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Richard Gonzalez is one of the people displaced by the storm.
Correcto, pagando mi cosas allá, pagando la.
I'm paying for my things back home, the cost of living for my wife in Puerto Rico, and at the same time, I'm trying to save up a little to get an apartment. But here you need to pay 3 months' rent just for a deposit.
In Puerto Rico, Richard was a casino worker, but after the storm hit, he left his wife and adult children behind to look for work in Florida. He's been staying in the Extended Stay America Hotel in Fort Lauderdale through FEMA's Transitional Sheltering Assistance Program. But his time is running out.
ahora mismo ellos dicen que no dan más ayuda. O sea, me refirieron a muchas entidades.
They're telling me that there's not going to be any more money. They referred me to all these charitable organizations in Fort Lauderdale, in Miami, but none of them could help me out. The ones that I reached out to on the phone, they said they didn't have any funding. They didn't have anything.
June 30th was the deadline for displaced Puerto Ricans to leave the hotels they'd been staying in. That deadline has already been extended 4 times in the months since the storm.
I believe that I have the hotel until tomorrow or Wednesday, but I don't know if they're going to continue paying for it. And I don't know anything. Nobody's told me anything. There's no communication. Nobody's called me from FEMA.
On Saturday night, a federal judge in Massachusetts blocked the evictions, granting another temporary extension for evacuees. That decision allowed the evacuees to remain in their temporary housing until tomorrow. FEMA pushed that deadline to Thursday. And just today, after we spoke with Richard, another federal judge in Massachusetts extended the deadline to leave hotels by 20 days to July 23rd. On Monday, Richard told us the uncertainty is difficult.
This experience hasn't been the best. It was horrible in Puerto Rico after the storm. 4 months without electricity, looking for something to eat, looking for gasoline, looking for food. A horrible experience. Unfortunately, many people who came here came with a desire to improve their lives and keep moving forward. Like in my case, I don't want to live here. I don't want to live off the government. I just want some help to move forward. At least just find a place to live, a place to sleep. But I have my career. I have the desire to continue improving myself. Last week, I was chosen as one of the employees of the month at the casino for my attitude, for my behavior, for my productivity. There's a lot of people who don't have it as good as I do. They don't have the opportunities that I have or the resources that I do.
Aaron Leibowitz is a local politics reporter for the Miami Herald, and he's been covering the situation that displaced Puerto Ricans find themselves in. I spoke with him before the most recent extension.
So the Temporary Shelter Assistance Program is a program that FEMA offers to displaced families after natural disasters. And essentially how it works is that families need to prove that they are in dire conditions. They need to prove that their homes are uninhabitable. So in the case of Hurricane Maria, FEMA officials went out to many of these homes in Puerto Rico to confirm that essentially they had been destroyed. That program began around October. It's since been extended on now 5 different occasions, and there are about 17,000 Puerto Ricans who have taken advantage of it across the United States since the storm hit. From FEMA's perspective, this is designed to be a short-term assistance program. It's not intended to put victims in long-term housing. And yet, because the situation in Puerto Rico has been so dire, they've continued to extend the program.
What exactly is FEMA's responsibility when it comes to disaster relief? Is it just providing emergency housing?
Well, that's part of the argument in this lawsuit that was filed on Saturday by a group called Latino Justice, which is essentially saying not only does FEMA have a responsibility to house these families while they don't have a place to go back to in Puerto Rico, but the argument is FEMA has a responsibility to make sure that these people have a long-term housing solution. And at least in the judge's initial ruling, a federal judge in Massachusetts, he seemed to say that there was compelling evidence that FEMA had not fulfilled its duty to find more long-term solutions for these families.
So let's talk a little bit about the state of Florida. What role does the state of Florida play, or have they played, in supporting these families? And even more broadly, outside of just the post-Maria wave of Puerto Rican migration, there's also been a consistent wave of Puerto Rican migration to the state of Florida. What role is the state playing in this? Is the state attempting to find more permanent solutions for the Puerto Ricans that are coming?
Right. Well, that's also a matter of contention. Some advocates here in Florida told me that they were actually hopeful that Governor Rick Scott would offer to house these displaced Puerto Ricans even after the FEMA temporary shelter program had expired, what Governor Scott essentially said was that this is on FEMA. It's not in the state's control. It's interesting given that actually in New York City, Mayor de Blasio came out and said that the city would pay to help keep displaced Puerto Rican families in their hotels once the FEMA funding had expired. And so that paints a bit of a contrast. It's also interesting because Governor Scott is currently challenging Senator Bill Nelson here in Florida for his Senate seat. A huge part of that race is trying to win over Puerto Rican voters. Governor Scott has been running ads saying that, you know, he was the one who was really there for these families after Hurricane Maria. Senator Nelson was recently on the Senate floor, essentially pleading with his fellow senators to compel FEMA to extend this temporary housing program. And so it seems like the general feeling is that FEMA needs to do something. And it appears that at the state level, at least for this temporary shelter program, there's a feeling that this needs to come from the federal level.
And just circling back, what are Richard Gonzalez's plans from here on out?
Well, last I spoke with Richard, he's been working as a dealer at a casino in the Fort Lauderdale area, and he really wants to continue doing that. He doesn't see an immediate opportunity to return home because he says he needs to provide for his family back on the island, and he doesn't think there will be any jobs for him there. Now, if the FEMA temporary shelter program is canceled, it's really unclear what he'll do. He does have some family, luckily, living in Central Florida who he could go stay with, but he would have to find another job in that area. And it's interesting, he actually acknowledges he might be one of the lucky ones among these remaining families. He's on his own and does have a job currently, and actually, if necessary, has a house that he could return to that's in Puerto Rico that has been rebuilt. And yet he sees the job situation in Puerto Rico as being so dire that he really doesn't want to go back.
Aaron Leibowitz is a local politics reporter for the Miami Herald. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I was born in a refugee camp in Kenya called Kakuma. It was a UN camp.
That's the voice of Halima Adin.
My family's originally from Somalia. And then after the civil war, my mom actually fled the country in 1994. It was a 12-day trek into Kenya on foot, and she found refuge in Kakuma.
Halima Adin's story begins in that refugee camp, but it doesn't end there. Today, the 20-year-old is an internationally known fashion model on the cover of this month's issue of Teen Vogue wearing a hijab. And this week, she's been named a UNICEF ambassador, and she says that's particularly meaningful for her, given her own background.
So I spent the first 7 years of my life at the camp, and I always say I had a great childhood because I remember the community, and I remember the kids, and I remember having friends, and it's kind of different to like what a lot of people imagine life on a camp would be like, but it was really like the sense of community that made me feel like I had an amazing childhood.
And can you describe what kind of a camp it was? Because, I mean, even though you said it was something that you grew up in and you have happy memories of, it was a refugee camp, right? That can't be something that's easy to grow up in.
No, it's not easy. My childhood consisted of, if I wasn't out playing, you know, like in the dirt and running around with my friends, I had malaria. Or some days my mom didn't know where our next meal would come from. So there's definitely obstacles, but refugees have this sense of like this great resilience and pride, and a lot of them don't ever see themselves as victims. I used to think I was crazy telling people I had a good childhood, and then they'd be like, in a camp? How does this work? How is this possible? And then going back as an adult and seeing how happy these kids were, like they were running to like the cars and just waving, and but that's not to say that they're not children, and they still have needs, and there's still work to be done.
So from this camp, when did you end up coming to the United States?
I came to the United States when I was 7. It was a very vigorous screening to get into the States. And the vetting process took my family a couple years, actually. But after that was all good, we moved to St. Louis, Missouri, and that's where we relocated from Kakuma. And it was, life was a little difficult just to adjust because it's a new culture, new environment. And then the school that I went to didn't have an English immersion program. So I literally went to school every day and didn't learn a thing. So it was hard to make friends. Let's just put it that way.
So here you are, 7 years old in the United States. You don't speak the language. You guys came from a refugee camp. It took a little while to adapt, you're saying.
Yeah. And also my mom noticed how like the area was, there's violence. So she wanted us to, you know, she wanted to really give us the best shot and the best chance to really thrive in America. So when she saw that St. Louis, that neighborhood that we were in, was not the right fit for us, she actually moved the entire family to St. Cloud and making it in America.
You wear a hijab and you're wearing one on the cover of Teen Vogue this month. Is that right?
So my cover just launched and I'm so excited because the title of like the cover is I Am America. And the shoot is even more beautiful because it's like, On one like picture, I'm wearing like it's tourist, you know. So I have like the binoculars. Is that what they're called here? And then another one, I'm like Jackie Kennedy type of thing. So it was a really fun shoot. I got to like test out my acting skills.
Now all of this is while you're wearing a hijab.
Mm-hmm.
And so why is that? I mean, what do you think they were trying to do with that juxtaposition of imagery with you with the hijab and these very sort of American folkloric scenes, if you will?
It's just, it gives the readers a chance to visualize someone who does wear the hijab and get them to understand, yes, you are American. You know, it doesn't matter if you have the wig or the bob or whatever that hairstyle was back then, or a hijab. You know, it's just a different way to be an American, and that's perfect. That's what our country is all about.
Now, we're in a moment that's a very polarizing moment right now. There's lots of divisiveness happening, particularly with folks that are coming to the United States as refugees or those that are seeking asylum. When you hear about the news, when you hear about the kids, for example, that are on the southern border, do you feel any specific way about that?
I would say it doesn't matter if it's a child in Wisconsin or a child in Mexico or Kakuma, like I was, you're still a child. So we all need to come together as a community to make sure that these children are being protected, that they're given the opportunities to thrive and just be kids. It doesn't matter what their status is. They're children first. And hopefully my story will bring hope to the kids who are in similar circumstances. And also, I think sharing your story, it has a lot of, like for me, I've noticed how people are very receptive and they have a better understanding when I do explain why my family is here, what brought us over here. And, you know, so I feel like that part, it allows people to be empathetic, and I don't want that to get lost, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that's important, sharing your story so people have a better understanding as to why you fled your country, as to what brings you here, because it's really not any different than what brought their family a couple generations ago.
Mm-hmm. We just saw the president and the Supreme Court actually say that the quote-unquote Muslim ban was something that the country is going to move forward with. How do you feel about that?
Being a Muslim hijab-wearing woman myself, it was disappointing because I see all the benefits of allowing refugees in. Like, my family came here and we chased down the American dream, and here I am today. I've grown since coming here. This is the place that I call home because people believed in me and allowed me to be a kid and allowed me to grow. It's allowed me to be here at this point, giving back to that same community. So I think refugees, children, they're our biggest investments, because those people will give back. And it's something that America should take great pride in. Like, America raised me. If it wasn't for my teachers, my neighbors, my community, people who looked the complete opposite of me, who practice a different faith, for example, I don't know if I would have been the person that I am today. So I think it's also this sense of pride that the neighbors should have, like the people who live in this country, you know? I had something to do with who she is today, whether that was my social worker or that was, you know, that's how I feel about it.
Halima Aden is a model and UNICEF ambassador. Thanks for joining us, Halima.
Thank you so much.
These days, it feels like we're more polarized than ever. And as we head into July 4th, our big question today was this. Are you feeling patriotic this year?
This is Emily from Mount Holly, New Jersey. I'm not feeling especially patriotic this year. I'm not really sure what our country has to be proud of. Our country is getting closer to corruption, collapse, and or revolution.
Hello. My name is Babette Horn from Wedgefield, South Carolina. My blood runs red, white, and blue. It is an unfair, biased opinion that to be pro-America, you must deny what principles we were founded on. A nation that disrespects its history will devalue its future.
Hey, this is David from New York City. The only kind of patriotism that I think is worth a damn is gratitude for the good things that your country provides for you.
Saddest 4th of July ever. Americans have lost their way. We are not free.
Lately, I think patriotism is marked by vigilance to the authoritarian in the Oval Office. I am currently hyper-vigilant, so by my definition, I am super patriotic. Have a happy 4th, everybody.
Hi, this is Kim from Tampa, Florida. Now, more than ever, the words of Oscar Wilde ring true. Patriotism is the virtue of the vicious.
My name is Tony from Traverse City, Michigan. I have no idea what patriotism is anymore. It's hard to feel patriotic when you've lost faith in all three branches of your government, in addition to knowing all the horrible things we've done throughout history. Just not feeling it this year.
Hi, this is Jane calling from San Francisco. I feel urgently patriotic right now. There's nothing like the prospect of losing my rights that makes me appreciate what I have and want to fight for it.
This is BJ Anderson from Scio, Oregon. You ask if I feel patriotic this year, and my response is hell no. My grandfather fought in the Great War. My father fought in World War II, and it was not for the America I see today. I am absolutely embarrassed to identify as an American at this point.
Hi, my name is Marianne Campbell. I'm from Santa Rosa, California. I served in our United States Navy for 5.5 years, and I just love my country, warts and all. And I don't judge my country based on who sits in the White House, but rather on the people that are all around me. And I look around, and I see a wonderful country full of giving, generous, hardworking people of all kinds. So do I feel patriotic? Yes, I do.
The truth is, we've been having some really tough conversations in this country, conversations about democracy, race, and equality, and what it means to be American. And we'll be exploring this notion of American identity on the show tomorrow. But for my next guest, it was the sacrifice of military service that really got him thinking about the meaning of patriotism. Matt Young is a Marine Corps veteran who served 3 tours in Iraq between 2006 and 2009, and he's also the author of a memoir called Eat the Apple, and he joins me now. Welcome, Matt.
Hi, Tanzina. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about your background, because a lot of who you are really influenced your decision to join the Marines.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fairly impulsive decision, I think. I was kind of lost as a kid. I was growing up in the Midwest. I had gotten into, you know, just things high school kids do. I was drinking and crashed my car into a fire hydrant after drinking one night and ended up walking into a recruiter's office the next day because I felt like, you know, I was doing something wrong with my life, and ended up signing up for the Marine Corps because the Marines were the only office open.
So were you thinking at the time about patriotism and what it meant to be an American when you signed up, or it just sounds like you figured, let me just do this and see where it goes?
Yeah, I think I was thinking, let me just do this and see where it goes. And once I got there, I think I felt so lost that I bought into those things really heavily. And I think my journey afterwards has kind of been kind of this discovery of, you know, what patriotism really is and how it's been so empty and been perceived as so empty over the last, you know, 17 years that we've been at war as a country.
And why do you say it's been perceived as something that's empty?
Well, a lot of the time we get, you know, around Memorial Day or Veterans Day or Independence Day or whatever, there's like this rise in militarism and flag waving and yellow ribbon kind of slapping the sticker on it and all those kind of things. And that legitimately, I think, feels pretty empty for the most part, because it feels like people are kind of rolling out the carpets on those particular days, and they don't really want to engage with the hard truths that exist in the culture we've created around the military, and especially being at war for 17 years and what that means. And people really just want to mostly feel not complicit in sending the military to war. And so they do the thing where they thank you for this, your service, they call you a hero, and they put a yellow ribbon on the back of their car and say that they support the troops. And I think that, you know, while a lot of people, I think, definitely feel genuine about that, and they legitimately want to thank you for what you're doing, I think that it's inherently a really selfish act to thank somebody for their service. And I think that it's really interesting and telling that, you know, we look to veterans and service members for their takes on patriotism too. We're all still trying to figure it out ourselves, and a lot of us have really complicated relationships with it.
To the idea of patriotism.
Yeah, absolutely.
The word patriot, particularly in the last year or so since we've had our current administration in office, has taken on a bit of a political tone. Would you agree? And if so, how do you see that impacting the meaning of the word patriotism?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a political term. I think that, you know, mostly what's happened is that people have kind of conflated nationalism and militarism with patriotism. We've been kind of put in this place where the administration has made us feel like being questioning of motives is an unpatriotic act, when I feel like it's probably one of the most patriotic acts that you can possibly exercise, you know, as a citizen, is dissent and questioning your government. And I think, you know, those are kind of the ideals that America is about. We're about questioning, and we're about anti-fascism and anti-imperialism. You know, the optimistic part of me wants to believe that where we've been for the last 2 years has mobilized people, and it's changed the political landscape in ways that people will be writing about in history books for years to come. I do think that providing a megaphone for the voices that are out there right now that are claiming that you can't be a proud American and love America and also not love immigrants, I think giving a megaphone to those voices is problematic. And that's really what's happened, right? Is we've amplified those voices. And that's what being a patriot is all about. It's about, you know, enforcing those ideals, allowing people to come to a country that supports freedom of speech and supports those inalienable rights that we have as people and citizens of this country. And we get to allow those things to happen and people to have those rights. That's what being an American is about, not taking those rights away from people or preventing people from getting those rights, or thinking that because some strange lottery happened and you had the good fortune of being born in the United States, that makes you better than somebody else. I think that those are the things that we have to remember. And those are kind of like the spaces of optimism that I have right now.
Matt Young is a Marine Corps veteran who served 3 tours in Iraq and author of the memoir, Eat the Apple. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tanzina.
Hi, this is Lynn from Tampa, Florida. I will be celebrating the 4th of July. My son has been deployed to Syria. The rhetoric on everything from Trump has been tough on military families. My boy comes home this week and he is a true patriot. I celebrate his homecoming and reunification with his wife and a 15-month-old daughter who doesn't really know him.
Hello, my name is Sue, and I'm calling from Salt Lake City. Yes, I feel patriotic. I feel very patriotic. I'm very happy about how this country was founded, and I'm very sad at this moment that we have a bully for a president. I hope and pray that all Americans can learn how to make compromises and get along.
What does patriotism mean to you? You can tweet me at Tanzina Vega. You can tweet us at The Takeaway, or you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. Tomorrow, we'll have a special hour on American identity. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.